On this episode of Still Loading, Chad Sider and the Game Theory Concert. Hello everyone and welcome to this newest episode of Still Loading. Thank you all for tuning into this week's episode, and thank you to everyone who checked out the Mario Month episodes that I just released, you know, a couple weeks ago. They were a ton of fun to record, and I can't thank Casey enough for joining me for Mario Month this year, as you know, as well as last year. But we're not here to talk about Mario this week. This week I had the pleasure of interviewing Chad Sider, who is a composer for film, TV, and of course video games. Chad has worked on so many different projects, it's incredible. Some of the big ones that you may have heard of is that he created and organized the Legend of Zelda Symphony of the Goddess Tour, as well as the Pokemon Symphonic Evolutions Tour. He's also famous for working with composer Michael Giacchino, who did the soundtrack for Up and Ratatouille and a bunch of others, which Chad also worked on. Chad was seriously one of the nicest people I've ever met. It was such a joy to get to talk to him about retro gaming and video game collecting and his upcoming Game Theory music concert. But you're going to have to listen to the episode to find out more about that Game Theory concert. It's seriously awesome. But yeah, so that's all I really had for the top of this episode. And without further ado, this is my interview with Chad. One of my favorite things to do on the internet is to dive down an IMDb rabbit hole, and I always love finding out who's worked on what, and I find even more enjoyment when I discover someone who has worked on a ton of the things that I know and love, but had no idea that they've worked on so many of the things that I know and love. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing Chad Sider, who has worked on a lot of things you may have heard of, and maybe not. So Chad, thank you for coming onto the show today. How are you doing?
Thanks, Josh. That was a really nice introduction. I appreciate that.
No problem. So the main thing we wanted to talk about today, we're going to get to a little bit later, and you're coordinating a big video game concert event coming up soon. But before we dive into that, I want to know a little bit more about you. So what got you into music? Like, what got you started into composition or composing or just music in general?
Well, I would say my whole life I've been really interested in puzzles. And as a result, I've always been really interested in technology, computers. I've always been very progressive and in that, and always dabbled. And after a while, I always loved music, and I always loved the technicality of it, especially with orchestra, even from being young. And I'd listen to like different symphonic recordings of my favorite classical pieces, and I would like A/B the differences. So, I just started getting interested in music, and I learned about MIDI files at one point, and like, which was cool because it was like a recording that you could edit. So I would just start, I just started fooling around with it in like a free open source sequencer back in like, you know, the mid 90s probably. And I remember the first thing I ever did was, I took a MIDI file of the Star Trek First Contact main theme that had like just come out. And I opened it in my little makeshift sequencer, and I learned you could change the track instruments. And so the French horn played the theme, you know, I don't know if you know what the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I was like, I'm going to put it on tubular bells. And so it was like clong, 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 clong. And I was like, there I go. I'm rocking it. Look at this. And that's like when it began, like going down the rabbit hole of studying music.
That's funny, because so we're not diving into it just yet, but I always like to dive into people's, you know, credits and their IMDb history, like I mentioned at the top of the show. One of the things I saw you were on the sound department for, just in speaking of MIDIs, was for Ratatouille. You were the MIDI supervisor.
Yeah, so what I would do on a lot of Michael Giacchino projects is I would do the score preparation. So I would take his files and prepare them for the orchestrator. So I was like kind of the middleman that processed all the notation and everything. And Ratatouille was one of the first big projects I did that on my own, that I was in charge of it, which is a very scary thing when you have to process someone else's music on something like that important. So it's like, if I make a mistake, I'm in big trouble because I'm reporting to nobody but myself.
So is that what the MIDI supervisors do? They kind of take the MIDI version of what the final orchestration is supposed to be so it can kind of help the... would it be the conductor of the orchestra or...
It's more like, think of it like you're translating a language. So, okay. You know, you do the, like I write in a program called Digital Performer, but I use a program called Sibelius to orchestrate the music. Both of them do different things. Like starting ideas is easier in Digital Performer. Finishing ideas is easier in Sibelius. That's where you write in, you know, that's where your technical finesse over the orchestra happens. But someone has to take the data out and put it into the other one. So that's what it is. It's essentially like an intermediary where, you know, you take the MIDI data out of your audio program and then you have to clean it up and translate it. You're transcribing it. So, which is a really hard task because when you're importing a MIDI file into a sequencer, you know, they don't necessarily speak the same language. So, you have to just go through and check all the notes and make sure like what you're doing is correct. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, because you might have drawn something a little differently in your audio sequencer that does not translate to orchestra correctly. So I have to like read the MIDI data and say, this is what's going on and fix it, you know? And sometimes you just get a bunch of weird triplets that don't make sense. And you're like, what is this rhythm that I'm hearing? And you have to go figure out what's exactly going, you have to go analyze the data. So it's like a really, really important job because if I make a mistake, then, you know, like as a composer, when I hand my work off, I don't necessarily check the MIDI transcription.
Yeah.
There's no time. So what happens is the music comes from me and then goes to the orchestrator who's going to do the orchestration and prepare the final thing for the orchestra.
Okay.
But if the orchestrator gets a piece that has mistakes in it, they're going to just orchestrate it. They're not going to know. So, and in fact, if I make mistakes that are wrong, they might try to correct it, which makes it even worse.
Because then they might not be getting the original intent.
Yeah, like I might have I remember on Ratatouille specifically, there was like this motif and it had one changing note every so often. Mm-hmm. And I just like repeated the whole thing to save time. And I got in trouble because the rhythm changed. I mean, the notes changed, but the rhythm was the same.
Okay.
And so it's like really meticulous. You got to sit there and read every line and check it against what you've got and convert it to a musical language for the orchestrator. So, tough job.
That is surprisingly in-depth for something that like is a job that probably not a lot of people know about.
It's not. It's one of the, you know, just like every job on the planet, like there's any business, it's got all the under-the-hood stuff that no one even considers is an actual thing. But this has to happen for literally any piece of music that's in a film that someone has to go do this.
that's just nuts to me. But I always like to hear about different composers' styles and whatnot. So I'm not explaining this that well, but what I mean by that is every composer kind of has like a
their sound.
Yeah, their own personal sound. So in your own words, how would you describe your own sound? Like, you know, is there like a motif that you continuously, maybe not, obviously not, or I'm assuming not like a melody or anything, but is there something that you continuously hearken back to or come back to each time?
Yeah, much like James Horner would always do like, da-da-da-da, like something he goes, his devices, as I like to call them, they're devices.
That's a better way to describe it than what I just said.
Yeah, I have had my music, one of my friends said, what I write always sounds like a death march. And like, it's very much very characteristic. And in fact, Michael Giacchino once said to me, he's like, you're such a happy person. Why do you write such angry music? And I said, what makes you think I'm happy? So like, I definitely have a style where I feel like my music, I try to, I have a lot of anxiety just in life. In everything I do. So I feel like my music comes from this perspective of overcoming diversity. So I do these like big builds that kind of feel like trudging through snow, you know, like, you know, shielding your face, walking into the wind is how I try to approach it as a storytelling device. So, I personally, I've been told I have a very unique sound, that it's easy to figure out when it's my music they're hearing. I appreciate that. And I try to always be thinking of what I'm going to do next. So, you know, that always feels good when I hear, cause it means I think I'm doing something right.
That's funny. I can relate to that a lot, actually. I mean, it's not something that I deal with consistently, but I deal with anxiety for myself a decent amount. So it always takes a lot for me to like kind of get over that initial hump. Once it gets going, it's a lot easier, but that anxiety building up to it. So I can relate to that a lot. So I'm going to actually like keep that in mind next time I listen to your music. I was listening to a little bit of your Recore soundtrack beforehand, and
yeah,
I'll have to like go back and listen to it in a new way.
That's one of my, I'm super proud of that work. It's what I like to call my other finest work. I just did a score. I'll talk about this later. Talk about game theory. I'm featuring my music in the show too. And, I wrote a score that's for this game that's literally about anxiety. And I consider that they're both my other best score. Like I consider them each my other best score. So, those are my two babies.
So do you have to change your approach on composition depending on what you are composing for? Like, do you have to change how you think when it comes to writing for a film versus writing for a game versus just writing just orchestral music that's not tied with anything?
Right. Yes. I mean, I do and I don't. I mean, there's certain things that in my thought processes that I do that are agnostic of the media that I'm writing music for. So, for example, as I said, I try to approach everything from a sense of adversity, overcoming adversity. So that just unto itself influences how I tell a story. But what's most important, and every composer has a different answer for this, but like, I guess I don't really care what I'm writing for. Like, it's all about the story to me. So whatever story I'm telling, whether it be an original work that exists nowhere, or if it's to picture or to a video game, like it doesn't matter to me. I'm always going to approach it from the exact same mindset. I mean, the technical specifics change. Film has a wildly different technological precipice than like games do. And you know, that like film is what I like to think of as linear entertainment, where games are non-linear entertainment. So the technical side changes, but how I approach it always remains the same. So I always try to maintain a sound throughout all my scores. Like the orchestra might change, the instrumentation might change, the chords I typically use the most might change, but at the heart, it's definitely a Chad Sider score. And I'm proud of that. I've made sure to, like, as I've added on projects, I've made sure to kind of keep a trajectory of form to my career, where I feel like I'm growing one big piece of music every time I'm writing different ones, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. Is there any like medium you prefer to write for? Do you enjoy writing for film more, or for games more, or maybe just for yourself, just something to do in your spare time when you have spare time?
Well, I have one son and a new baby 3 weeks away, so not as much spare time for writing as much as I'd like. Usually it's reserved to, you know, at this point. I also think that, like, writing music in your free time is not necessarily a good idea when you do it for your job, because...
Makes sense.
I mean, you shouldn't really do anything. In my opinion, you shouldn't really do your job outside of your job as much. Like, you'll burn out if you do that. So I try to remain fresh, and it allows me to think more on what I'm doing, what I have done, rather than what I should be doing. But I would say my favorite medium is always change depending on like how my life is going or what I have interested in. You know, like I love video games, but like, you know, if a game doesn't come along for a while, and I'll miss it. But you know, right now I'm trying to get back into film, and because I've let that muscle sort of atrophy for a while, and it's time to get back into it. I've done concerts, which is a whole different skill set. And it's like, I feel like I do a whole lot of things that I like them all equally, and I'm riddled with ADHD anyway, so I don't want to be doing one thing for too long. I like to move on to different ideas that have different requirements. Otherwise, my life feels stagnant after a while.
And we'll get to your concerts, your concert organization, or your concerts that you've organized a little bit later on, because that's a big thing I actually really want to talk about as well. But in speaking of video games, what are some of your favorite games that you've played, like whether growing up or recently, or just what are some of your favorite games?
Well, I'm a huge Mega Man 2 fan. I would say that's my favorite game of all time.
Excellent.
Right up there is like Castlevania 4 on Super Nintendo.
Okay, the Super Nintendo.
Freaking love that one. I can speedrun that one.
Yeah?
Like, I'm really fast. Yeah. And Mega Man 2, I can speedrun both of those. I don't do the like cheats, you know, like breaking the programming, but as a like hit forward and just keep going, I can rock it. I really love Metroidvanias. I'm playing right now Bloodstained from the Symphony of the Night creator.
Yeah.
I'm addicted to it. I was worried, like, I didn't contribute to the Kickstarter mostly because, like, I've been hurt before, and I try not to invest my emotions into Kickstarters. And then when they first started releasing images and stuff, I was like, okay, we'll see. And then their demo, okay, we'll see. But now that I have the final thing, you know, I'm playing it on Xbox One. It's in 4K. Looks awesome. Love it. So that's like my favorite game right now. But I like all kinds of things. I like 2D games the most, though.
I'm with you on that. This is a video game podcast, so obviously I love video games, but it's strange for me. I want a strange path to kind of end up loving 2D games more than 3D in a weird sense. So I started out, I'm a little bit younger. I started out on the N64. And so I started out on 3D games, even though I am old enough. There are Super Nintendo should have been my first console. My parents didn't really get that for me when I was a kid. But as I got older and I kept developing this love for video games, I actually ended up going back, and now I have this bizarre obsession with like pixel art. And so I'm so happy that the indie game scene has kind of made a renaissance of 2D pixel art games again.
It's because our generation is starting to come into a position of making decisions, mm-hmm. you know, and just like any generational shift. I mean, cassette tapes are coming back, you know.
Yes.
We already went through the vinyl revolution, and now it's like people are starting to actually want cassette tapes. And I mean, I just saw that they make that Sony is making a new Walkman that like can convert tape to MP3 or whatever, and I'm
that's
just like,
freaking awesome.
Well, to you maybe.
I don't miss cassette tapes, but I like the idea that it converts cassette tapes.
Cassette tapes are a product of the 80s, so is pixel art. So, you know, here's our generation's time to shine.
It's strange, too, for me, because I'm old enough for, like, I was born in 89, so I'm old enough for the Super Nintendo. That should have been, like, my childhood console. But
you were, like, three. I was born in 82.
Okay.
So, but you were, like, three, so you're off the hook on that one.
I guess. So I had friends who are only a year older than me who actually had a Super Nintendo growing up, and I was always kind of jealous of it because there's a lot of games on there now that are, like, super rare that I wish I could own, but...
Yeah.
It's not that much of a problem, but I'm a collector as well, so it hurts me a little bit to know that I missed out on a lot of it. Yeah,
I went through and bought, like, when, you know, after you get a little older and you've got some spare change mm-hmm. starting to accumulate and you want to use it, like, one of the best parts about, you know, getting older, and I grew out my retro game collection. I had all my hardware modified to really gorgeous output spec to
1080p. Like RGB output type of thing?
Yeah, or just skipping all that and going straight to like coming off the graphics processor into HDMI.
Oh, that's
and then
awesome.
Analog makes a bunch of things that I've mostly switched over to just buying those things.
Mm-hmm.
Like their Super NT and stuff, because it's awesome. But I have a retro game collection of at least 1,000 games. And one of the things I did was like, what are all the old games that I didn't have that all my friends had that I played at their houses? And it made me so mad I didn't have it. So that was like the first thing I did.
It's funny because you're talking about how, you know, the cyclical effect of, you know, the generation that grew up on things. Now they're in a position to make decisions. It's like that way in the collector's market too. I mean, Atari collecting was really big about a decade or so ago. And then everyone kind of stopped caring about it. And now the 8-bit the kids who are now adults want to kind of, you know, buy back their childhood. So NES and Super Nintendo are really big. And now eventually you're already starting to see it, like PlayStation 2 and GameCube and original Xbox games are starting to get up there in price. There's a couple that
Which
are already 100.
Bizarre to me personally.
And it's going to be like once like PS4 and PS3 really. PS3 and PS4 starts becoming more collectible, it's going to make me feel really weird. And it's just going to keep happening.
Well, eventually that stuff will be retro, and then the stuff we liked as a kid will be vintage, and that's where you don't want to go. Vintage is the graveyard of retro.
I will still always love it though.
Well, I will too.
There is a not completely related or affiliated with my podcast at all, but there's a YouTube channel, maybe you've heard of it, called My Life in Gaming.
Oh yeah, I love those guys. I've chatted with them over Twitter and stuff a few times. Love it.
I'm obsessed with their channel. I love everything. Like I showed my friend their videos, who he was not 100% into like retro gaming and collecting. He liked it and, you know, respected it well enough, but it wasn't something he was that invested in. But once I showed him their videos, because he's more of a tech kind of guy, and he saw all the interesting technology that people are now making to get the best possible video picture out of your retro game consoles, he just freaked out, and he found a Super Nintendo with the perfect chipset and got one of the upscalers and everything. He just went nuts with it.
I did too. Almost my wife was starting to get kind of upset with me. I went so nuts on it. So
my wife's been very forgiving of me with all the money I've spent on game collecting, but I try to keep it in check.
My wife too. I try not to break her heart too much.
So in speaking of retro games, I figured it's a little earlier than I wanted to go into this, but I think this is the best transition I can offer because I'm not great at transitions, but we're going to keep on going. Your music series based off of retro video games, your concert series, you did the Legend of Zelda, the Symphony of the Goddess. And I also saw a Pokemon concert series.
Yeah. So I had done both of those, Symphony of the Goddesses and Pokemon Symphonic Evolutions, where we were officially licensed from Nintendo and the Pokemon company respectively. So it was, you know, working with their IPs and it was really important to me that I did the arrangements too. So it all lived in the same sonic space. And you know how I talked about, it's funny, we talked about style because I really wanted to infuse my style into it because I basically wanted you to hear the way I heard it in my head growing up, you know, because you just got these, you know, these 8-bit, 16-bit sounds that they leave a lot to your imagination of how it sounds. And, you know, I'm so interested in the orchestra and orchestration. My whole life is devoted to working with the orchestra. I love it. So I would hear these big cinematic epics in my head. And, you know, I'd always want like, oh, they should have done this. That would have been cool. Like, now I can do that, you know, and I got to work with the original composers of those things. And I was really nervous, like Koji Kondo, the first time I showed him my arrangements, like, not like, I hope he likes it. I wasn't worried about that. It was more about, did I do it right? You know, like, is he going to think that this is a good interpretation of it?
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, he loved it, you know, and it was like this certain kind of acceptance, like always, it doesn't matter who it is. I'm always so nervous when I send out the first batch of music for delivery, I feel very vulnerable because like they're going to listen to it for the first time. We could have talked a big, I could talk a big talk, but now like my music, it's my music on the line and it's up to me to bring it. So whenever I send out the music for the first time, I'm always a nervous wreck. And on both shows, I was given just like creative freedom to do literally whatever I wanted. So, I put it totally like, this is what I hear in my head. And I turned it into like a Chad Sider hybrid score, which is exactly what I wanted for you guys to all hear it the way I heard it in my head growing up.
I actually went to one of the Symphony of the Goddess shows when you were touring. It was in Philly at, I think, the Mann Center.
Oh, cool.
I was actually at that show. And so when, you know, I don't remember. It's been a number of years. It would have been, I don't think it was the first Philly show that you guys ever did. It would have been the second one. Because I think you only ever did two, I think.
Well, I stopped working on it after a while.
I
due to production issues, I decided to leave the project. So there were additional shows that I might not have been involved in, but I was at least one Philly show.
It might have been. I know the game they kind of did the focus on was Link's Awakening, if that was anything.
Yeah, I was always really proud of that one, the Windfish queue. Oh, and I did the whole suite. It's been a while. It's been like 10 years.
I think the one I went to, how long ago did I live in that place? I think it was probably like 3 or 4 years ago now. Oh, it's got to be more than that. I don't know. It's been too long. But no,
well, I'm glad you came.
it was a great time. I remember leaving that that concert, and I'm like, I gotta go back and play some Zelda games I haven't played before, because there was at the time, I had actually only really beaten Ocarina of Time, and I think the DS game, not Spirit Tracks, but the other one that I cannot think of for the life of me right now. That's gonna bother me. Phantom Hourglass. That's what it is. And after that concert, I literally went back. I'm like, you know what? Damn it. I'm going to actually beat Link to the Past and Link's Awakening and all the ones that I've been meaning to get to and just haven't gotten around to.
Sometimes it's hard to go back to those games. You're like, oh, so much has changed.
I think the 2D Zeldas hold up really well in terms of like, longevity and how they fare against like the modern audience. Because if it was like, it's like when you go back to play Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, those don't hold up as well. Not just only visually because you're so used to more modern graphics.
Early in the 3D graphics era, I don't much care to play those games because I, to be honest, after Super Nintendo, I became a PC gamer for quite some time because I just didn't really like the way that the consoles were looking. It was 3D, but not really. It was still, you know, sprites, but in 3D. I just didn't much care for the graphic style at that time. So I went over, you know, and then it was Half-Life and stuff over on PC, which was like, holy crap, this is epic. So I never had played Ocarina of Time, but when I went back to play it, like I couldn't get past the tech, you know, like,
yeah.
It was hard.
There are certain games that hold up really well regardless of age. For example, just in speaking in the Zelda series, I actually think Wind Waker holds up very well considering that it's now almost, it's definitely 15 years now. It's going to be 20 years in like 2023 or something like that.
Yeah.
But like that game holds up really, really well. And even the Super Nintendo, like Link's Awakening, Link to the Past, like the controls and graphics visually hold up really well. The original Legend of Zelda, I think actually the graphics are still super appealing. The gameplay may feel a little dated, but I don't even say dated. Like it's just not as intuitive. It doesn't hold your hand like a lot of modern games do.
Like I find with retro games, if I didn't play them at the time, I have a hard time playing them now because I don't have that muscle memory, and oftentimes the physics is just so janky in a lot of games that I was accustomed to it. And you've been kind of, it's part of your intellect even to today, but you know, playing a new old game is not always the easiest.
It really is not. And that's why, you know, with collecting and whatnot, I have a bunch of old games that I've never played before. And when I go to try them, a perfect example, like Kid Icarus, everyone says how great Kid Icarus is. And I like it, but I'm so bad at it. Bad at that game.
Well, and it also doesn't hold that special place in your heart. Like, you know, my Zelda game was Link to the Past. Like, man, I 100% of that thing. But, you know, Ocarina of Time, you know, like, it didn't have any sort of like emotional impact on me as much because I wasn't really a part of that world at the time. So going back to it is always a little tough when you don't have that sort of built-in reverence for, you know, what your fingers remember most.
It's funny too, because I actually, like, my first Zelda game was Ocarina of Time, and even me, who has that like nostalgia for it, it's hard for me to go back, only because I think I actually played it too much, where the controls are only so fun that it doesn't make me want to go back and kind of redo it again.
Yeah. There's been such innovation in control and you know, like, even the I've been playing a lot of Bloodstained, I believe. I think I mentioned on this one.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, Bloodstained is awesome, and it's like, dude, this is totally a new Symphony of the Night, but it's way better. Like, everything's way thought out, and like, Symphony of the Night's gonna always be one of my favorite Metroidvanias of all time, but this is no slouch, you know. And I can do that one like in my sleep too. And Bloodstained is like, cool, these are modern controls. This is how it feels now. Like, these are, you know, it's got compensation for like wireless delay and stuff. And it's a whole different experience. I can't imagine like what it would be like to be that kid getting this game, you know, from, you know, playing Symphony of the Night. And then suddenly you have this, like, it would just, if there was like some sort of time dilation that allowed you to do that, it would probably just be like, just completely overwhelming. How much controls change.
100% I agree. It's funny because, you know, you were saying before, like, it's harder to go back to games that you don't have that nostalgic connection with. For me, one of the reasons that I actually started collecting games part of it is what I call misplaced nostalgia. And I've talked about it on my podcast before, but it's that, you know, the sensation where it's you're nostalgic for something that you never actually experienced personally.
Yeah.
And I feel that very hard about on a lot of different levels, like, especially, like I said, I started with the N64, but for some reason the NES just hits a sweet spot for me. It's a very strange thing. And I started collecting actually because I have a weird obsession. I shouldn't say weird. I just have an obsession with video game history. I like finding out things where there's like games that were ahead of its time, or like weird tech that you're surprised existed all the way back then. I've given this example before, but like, we're talking about Castlevania, but Simon's Quest, the second one, it actually blew my mind to find out about its day and night cycle and how the enemies change depending on whether it's day or night.
Right.
And it, you know, someone who didn't experience that as a kid, but, you know, looking at it 30 some odd years later, it surprised me so much because I was just blown away by how advanced the gameplay was, regardless of the flaws with it, how cryptic the game is, and it doesn't tell you anything on how to progress through the game. Need the strategy guide.
Simon's Quest in modern times is not playable. It's not playable. I would say all the Castlevanias are a little rough. The controls are definitely an acquired taste.
But all right. That's awesome. I always like finding like connections with the people I'm interviewing. So I had no idea you were a video game collector. So that's really cool.
I could talk about it all day. I'm proud of my collection, and I spent a lot of time on it and a lot of time thinking about it. So I've got it all set up. All my retro games work in 5.1 surround sound, and
it's beautiful.
Got the sub cranking and all those bass lines on the Nintendo, like, boom, the subwoofer just makes them sound so epic.
Do you ever go to like any gaming conventions near you? Like, I think the biggest one that I know of near you is the Portland Retro Game Expo.
Yeah, you know, I've wanted to, but like, it's always just hard to travel, like, with a kid now, it's like, it's hard to do any of that, but mm-hmm. I have to be so, like, I work so much that I have to be really particular of my time. And it's kind of hard to get away for those things. Like, I've always been told I need to go to MAGFest, but it's like in early January. And what sucks is, like, I just went through the holidays, and usually production cycles like wrapped up in mid December, but they get going right away. And so, like, it's always for me after like January 2nd, it's like back to work no matter what.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I just took the holidays off, and it's hard to get the time to go to those things, you know, when you're back at the grind.
In a weird way, I guess it's kind of a good problem to have, that you have so much work that you can't go to conventions like that.
Well, it's not always just work. Sometimes it's like, well, there's all kinds of, you know, the age old saying, composing is only 10% of the actual job, when in reality, it's probably like more like 5%. You've got to spend so much time networking and planning and long-term projections for your business that, like,
mm-hmm.
sometimes you just, it's like, I can't leave. I just got back. And it might not be I'm sitting down and writing. It's like, no, I have to organize, like, I have to get my new template going because this project is coming 3 weeks away and stuff like that. You know, it's like, there are also large swaths of time where you're not working.
What are some things that you like to do to kind of wind or unwind? Not, I was going to say wind down. I guess it's the same expression. But, like, is there any, do you listen to other music outside of obviously orchestral stuff? Or is it, do you like, are there any movies or like things that you like to do just to kind of de-stress from life and from the job?
I love hanging out with my family. I try not to work at night. I don't like working at night. So, unless I have to, of course, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. But most of the time, I try to be done with work around 5 PM. I like to start early and end early. I try to finish my work before 5 if I can. And then usually it's my wife or I pick up our son from the grandparents, and I try to spend the night just hanging out and playing. And I like to cook dinner. We'll have like the nightly news on and cooking dinner. Our son is playing. My wife is sitting at the table, maybe doing something. Like, it's just a busy household. And so that's kind of how I relax, to be honest. And we'll watch, after he goes to bed at 8, we'll like watch a movie or a TV show or something, or a few. And, or we'll just, you know, I'll just go sit in bed and work on my laptop, you know, catching up on emails. And we just have like, you know, some reality show on TV or whatever. It's just, I try to step away from work, and it doesn't really matter what fills it. Cause I always can fill it. It's just the nice decompression. Sometimes my ears are just overloaded and I need to walk away.
I completely understand that. Surprisingly enough, my decompression is not always, but a lot of times it's actually my job. So, you know, I do this podcast on the side, but I have a full-time job, and I get to listen to podcasts, not my own. I hate listening to myself, but I listen to podcasts like pretty much all day through my job. I'm very thankful that my job allows me to be able to just listen to music or podcasts or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So if I'm having a particularly stressful day at work, or even if there's just stuff going on in life, I get to go to work, and it's a little bit more solitary of a job. So I can kind of like tune everything out and just focus on work and focus on whatever I'm listening to. It's a really nice, almost but like meditative, but at the same time not, because I'm not being completely quiet.
Well, that's what, you know, to your point, you said like listening to music, like, I think most composers probably have this problem where you work on it all day, and it's like it's sort of hard to find the time to do it recreationally. Like, I don't particularly like listening to music in the car because it makes time feel slower to me. I think it's because, like, I know what it goes into producing a minute of music, so it just, like, the minute feels a lot longer. I'm more of a like talk radio guy in the car. Like, you have to find ways to decompress, because I'll be in the office researching and listening to stuff all the time, you know, and have stuff playing in the background as I'm researching or working on an idea. So I always like to kind of decompress from music in the evening.
No, I can understand that. I can't imagine what it would be like to have to take your work home with you. I'm thankful my job isn't like that. So I would probably be doing the same thing you were. And even like with this, like I love podcasting, I love talking about video games, but I don't think I could ever make this my full-time job. Or if I did, I need a part-time job to kind of just step away from it. Just kind of like, I love video games, but there's other things that I also enjoy to, you know, watch, yeah, listen, whatever, that kind of thing.
Well, I think having a varied life, like I would say, like for me, when I became a better musician was when I started traveling a lot more. You know, I'm very introverted, and I used to be a bit of a homebody, and until I got married, I had never traveled internationally, and now I've done it, you know, dozens of times. Once I started traveling and doing other things, then, you know, once music became my job and I no longer sat there worrying about like technology, sample libraries, whatever, like, and went out and experienced life, it's amazing how much I got better not doing music, like experiencing life and appreciating things. And it's as an artist, I've been told this and I agree with it, that the best thing you can do as an artist is travel. Mm-hmm. That's where you learn just the most about the world and about yourself. And it's cool. I like it. So
I can relate to that a lot as well. For me, I'm also a little, I would say I'm a bit of an introvert as well. I would say I'm an introvert in the sense where I get my energy from is from being alone. Like I don't gain energy from a crowd, or I don't gain energy from group hangouts. I love hanging out with friends. I like being kind of a little, sometimes I like being the life of the party type of thing, even though I don't know if I've ever been that, but I like to try. But where I get my most energy from is 100% just being a homebody. Like I like being up in my room watching YouTube videos, or in my game room watching YouTube videos, or sitting on the couch with my wife watching, we just finished Stranger Things season 3. Oh, it's so good. Just, you know, things like that. And I've even found that now I like to just go for walks, which I never thought I would ever say in my life. But I like to take Mark. We have a little corgi, so we take him out for walks at periodically to just parks and places we've never been to in our area. So I've started
working out. Like I have a trainer, and I've lost like 50 pounds. It's amazing how much that stuff just affects your mental health, and your physical health.
I rolled my ankle a week and a half ago, and it's healing now, but I haven't been able to go to the gym or go for a walk or anything. And I've been going a little stir crazy the last 2 weeks, just sitting in.
Yeah.
All right. So this has been great. I wanted to talk about one of the big things today. One of the main reasons we're even talking today is the upcoming concert series that you have, the Game Theory Music Concert. That is the right one. Yeah, Game Theory Concert.
Yep, Game Theory Concert.
So from what I saw online, the concert is a music concert for indie video games. And the lineup you have is just nuts. All the different composers that you have lined up for this is just incredible.
Thank you. So Game Theory is we're fundraising for a nonprofit called Musicians at Play, which serves the Los Angeles area, provides support for music education, indie artist exposure, jazz programs, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the director is April Williams, and her husband is Don Williams. He's the music director. Don Williams is an incredibly talented timpanist, one of the best. And so he's played on all my stuff for 15 years. He's also actually John Williams's brother. So,
That's nuts.
Plays timpani on all his scores. So when April had said, like, I want to do a video game show, and Don was like, boom, call Chad. And so I had the show bestowed upon me, which was really cool, because normally I have to put together a pitch and everything, but because it was just like given to me, I was so grateful. And I said, like, but because of this, I want to do something new. And much like we've talked about all the retro games, I feel like I love them, but I've done that now. And I'm ready to move on to the next phase of my creativity. And especially in modern times with, like, you know, these tech companies, politics, news, there's so much noise in your life now, social media, that, like, I felt like I need to start looking forward and figuring out what is going to happen in my life next, instead of, you know, as much as I love it, nostalgia and, like, you know, just moving on. Yeah, I've got kids coming, so more. So when I started it, I was like, well, indie games are going to be the new AAA games, that's for sure. And what I like about it is, like, it reminds me of my job, because as a composer, one of the things I love to do most is budgeting. I love to plan what the orchestra is going to be, how much time I have, all that. Mm-hmm. Budgeting is my favorite part, or at least one of them. So with game theory, like, the idea was that all these composers have had to come up with creative solutions to making games. And as a result, no two composers have the same story. So I wanted to create a show that had six composers that had different walks of life, and put them all together under the same umbrella cohesively, with a through storyline of that we're all making these games together, and everyone's got an interesting story. Like Austin Wintry is the triple I composer, as he told me that people have put it. It's cool. I've known Austin for a long time, from back when I was working on the TV show Lost, and he was an intern on that. Up until he had met my wife at some point, and my wife orchestrates all his music, Susie Sider. So in a way, Austin is, like, part of the family. And so Austin was a no-brainer. He has to be there. Like, it was important to me. Grant Kirkhope, I didn't know, but we had chatted on Twitter, and I really enjoyed getting to know him. He feels to me like American video game music royalty, in a sense that he not only started back, like, N64 and I think even before, but he has seen many generational shifts of consoles, and with all the technical limitations to those, he's always had to find a way to write cool music. And that's hard when technology changes. I have not myself had to experience the same thing that he had to. And it all culminates with, like, a bunch of the Rare people left and made Playtronic, which is a grassroots indie game that's kind of approached like a AAA platformer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Grant wrote the score to that. And so we're going to be premiering a lot of that with a live orchestra for the first time.
The ukulele stuff,
that's
right?
That's cool. The what?
Ukulele, right?
Oh, yeah, ukulele. So I'm really excited to hear that live. I'll just run down the list, because it's really cool. Laura Shigehara, who I didn't know, but I've gotten to know her through this, and I really like her. She's super cool. She made her own game, Rakuen, like, from beginning to end.
Really?
And she's built it, just celebrated 2-year anniversary. She's built a community based on positivity and friendship, and it's big too. And she really a part of it. And she writes such emotional music that is so personal to her. And I'm glad to learn that about her, because I look at music more like a puzzle, and she looks at music like how it makes you feel, in a way that I'm excited to collaborate with her, because I think we'll both be infusing those elements into the arrangements of her set. Then Lena Rain is new to me as well. Celeste is I'm sure you've played it. It's a 2D platformer. It's relentlessly punishing.
I've been meaning to.
Oh yeah, it'll definitely make you want to punch a wall. Like, there are times I wanted to throw the controller, like, that it was so stressful. But I really like her music. It's like, it has a lot of anxiety in it, but it's still peaceful, and it allows you to just screw up through your levels, but it still has this grounding. She had to be there, as far as I was concerned. I really liked it. And then Jake Kaufman, I met online on America Online back in, like, seventh grade, when you could type in on America Online, like, your interests. And so I had put in like film music and there was like 25 results or something. And Jake was one of them. So we became like online chat buddies back in like the mid 90s.
That's awesome.
Maybe even a little earlier than that. And so we grew up in our paths, you know, we lost touch and moved on, but we were both at something in Los Angeles and he was working as a composer here and I had gotten here working and it was like Jake Kaufman and he's like, Chad Sider. And it was like, oh shit, America Online. And like, so we've been really good friends since. So it's a no-brainer that, that Jake has to be there in the show too. So this is all like a very precisely curated cast and each composer is going to host their own segments. So each composer is going to have a 20-minute segment that they're going to talk through their body of work and like they're going to talk through like decisions they made or the limitations or the benefits, you know, and they're going to just share with you what it was to make this music for, and it just happens to be for these phenomenally important indie games. So like, it's going to be really cool. And I'm making sure to curate it like a museum where they're going to be working on the arrangements and we're going to do all the music preparation in my company. My wife also orchestrates all my music and she conducts my orchestras usually. But she won't be able to be at this show. She's conducting in Toledo. So I'm on my own on this one, but you know, we're all going to work on this together. So it's not going to feel like six composers that are there independent of each other. They're all there. We've all worked together and collaborated to make the music cohesive. And it'll be a really good night of positive energy. We're raising money for important causes. I'm just really excited about it.
It's really cool. I mean, a lot of these for the listeners who don't know what some of these people have done, like Jake Kaufman did Shovel Knight, which is probably one of the biggest indie games that come out in the last like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, Lena Raine did Celeste. Lara Shigihara did Plants vs. Zombies, right?
Yeah, she did. That's where I remember playing Plants vs. Zombies when it first came out, back when mobile games were fun. And I loved the music. I was like, this is very peaceful. It's kind of menacing and has a nice groove to it. And so it was fun to, it's fun to have her part of the production as well.
And then Grant Kirkhope, you mentioned before how he worked on, you know, like N64 and I believe even Super Nintendo.
I think so.
For the listeners may not know, Grant Kirkhope did Banjo-Kazooie. I think he also did Donkey Kong 64, and I'm 99% certain he did GoldenEye on the Nintendo 64 as well.
He did,
like,
yeah.
He's done a lot of like stuff that...
Those were the triple A's of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Austin did Journey. That was his big one a couple years ago.
Yep.
I also saw that I've been meaning to try it out, but Abzu also, he did Abzu. And I've been meaning to try that because it kind of reminded me of Journey a lot from what I saw.
Mm.
And then, of course, you with ReCore I saw. And then I also saw a bunch of the AAA games that you did with, oh my gosh, hold on. I have the links open right in front of me.
Well, I'm excited about my segment in particular. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten to really perform my own music for an audience, so I'm really excited to be one of the composers. And I'm showing off my score to an indie game called Archangel that one of my best friends, Zach Quarles, made. He was an audio director at Microsoft, and while he was working there, made this game, and I worked with Zach since... I did a game back with him in like 2007 called Fracture, and we met there and we've been friends since. So he made this point and click indie game, which is all sound design, which he tackled, and all music, which I tackled. And the game deals with a lot of anxiety and depression, which I am riddled with as well as an artist. Like I have a lot of anxiety in my life and it's sometimes really hard to manage it. And in fact, when I was writing on the score, I was on tour with Evanescence and Lindsey Stirling and care of my 5-month-old baby who was on the road with us, sleeping on the bus and everything. So, and I was having a literal mental breakdown during it. So the music is like is my testament, is like I wrote the score about me in a sense. And so it's really cool that I get to bring it full circle to my concert roots, because it's so personal, I've been converting it into my first symphony and making it symphonic form. And so I'm going to be premiering bits of my first symphony, which I'm excited about.
And what was this game?
Archangel.
Archangel. I didn't see it on your credits. That's why I was, at least I don't think I did.
Maybe I didn't update my website.
Wait, so how did composing for Archangel get you on a tour with Lindsey Stirling and Evanescence? That's crazy.
Oh, I was already on that. My wife was conducting. Evanescence did an orchestra tour and was hired to conduct the show. And then Evanescence and Lindsey Stirling did a doubleheader show, and I did all the arrangements for that. So, which was a lot of fun working with Lindsey, who is the hardest working person on this entire planet. And so I got to tour with Lindsey and Evanescence and Amy Lee, of course, who I absolutely loved back in college. It was cool to learn we're the same age. So she was doing all the Evanescence stuff when she was 18 years old. Like, I mean, she was running a label. It's incredible to me. So it was really hard because I was working on these arrangements, and then in my spare time, I'm literally on a tour bus with headphones writing music in my bus bay, like my little cubby that I sleep in, and hoping that I have enough, like my laptop doesn't, because it's running samples, like that it doesn't trip the like circuit on my cubby outlet and stuff like that.
That's crazy. That's such a cool story though. And you said that you your child, I don't know if you have a son or daughter.
My son, yeah. And he came along too. So he was 5 months old and we had a tour baby.
That's crazy.
And the band Evanescence taught him, because they're a rock band, taught him the importance of saying cheers. So his first word was cheers, and he would toast you, because we all would toast him with our after show booze. So he would walk, he would crawl around just going cheers, cheers.
That's great. That's awesome.
It was super cute. We have lots of videos with the band of that.
That sounds amazing. Like, my brother used to be in a band as well, and touring was like one of the toughest things. So I can only imagine like touring and composing and also raising a 5 month old child at the same time. That just sounds crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was really, really hard. And I was working on other things. Like, I'm in a sense, I'm kind of glad it happened, because I did have like a massive like panic attack breakdown, the kind where you reevaluate literally everything in your life and not always make the best decisions while doing it. And I'm really thankful for it, because it kickstarted something in me that needed to happen eventually anyway. And it made me decide, like, I can't look back anymore. I need to move forward. And the grand finale of the show, I wrote a piece for Archangel called Walk Past the Storm, which is literally the embodiment of my anxiety, where it's like you're fighting through this wind, like you're walking through a storm and you're just covering up against the wind. And you're like, oh, I got to keep going. You know, that feeling.
Yeah.
Of just the cold isolation of it. And while I was on tour, and I, even though everyone was there and could help me, I felt very alone and I didn't need to. And so the piece, the Archangel score, is like about that to me. So I've been going through tough time in parts of my life where I've written music and I don't like listening back to it, 'cause it reminds me of certain things.
Yeah.
But, and so theoretically I wouldn't enjoy listening to Archangel, but whenever I listen to it, I've smiled, because it's like I worked so hard to overcome that. So it's extra important to me and exciting that I get to share this, because it is so personal to me.
Yeah, that makes sense, because so it's not just like you're not just personally proud because you wrote something that you enjoy, but you're personally proud of it because it represents an emotional journey that you took to get over, you know, whatever anxiety you were dealing with at the time or whatever depression you were dealing with at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the best, that's the best moments of being an artist, you know? And plus it was kind of like when I always thought of music as a puzzle, like, oh, I can rock this cause it's a puzzle, blah, blah, blah. It's all just music theory. But it was that score where I learned like, oh, maybe it's not just about music theory. Like maybe I do need to start accessing this part of me, which I had not really prior accessed. And listening to Laura Shigehara talk, she's like helped me through a lot of my anxieties. Like I've learned from her actually while working on this project, hearing how she talks about music.
It almost sounds the way you you're composing is like how an actor kind of has to, you know, recall different emotions to get different performances out of them. So if they're trying to, you know, cry on in a scene, then they try to think back on something personal to do that. To get them to that point where they can be that open and vulnerable for the scene. It almost sounds like the way you were describing that is you were doing the same thing because you knew this, whatever piece of music you're writing had to evoke a certain emotion. So you were trying your best to put yourself back in a memory similar to that or something along those lines.
It was mostly that I would not say I did it intentionally. Like I was just so consumed by it for the first time. I had not really felt emotion like that before. That I it couldn't be ignored. Like for all the great things that came from the score, I can hear all the like things that decisions I made that I kind of refer to it as like prickly. Like things sound prickly in the score to me. These like sharp, you know, like when you injured yourself and you've got this like pain, like this sharp pain sometimes in your leg or something. Mm-hmm. Like things in that it's not perfect, and where normally I would have to like control the situation, everything needed to be perfect. And this is the first time it was like, I got to get this done. Like I don't have time to think. And like, as a result, I think it was the most emotional music I've ever written in a score.
I actually talked about something similar-ish to this to another composer I interviewed, Andrew Prallo. Do you feel like limitations like that whether it's self-imposed or whether it's, you know, crunch limitations, you have to get something done by a certain amount of time, do you feel like they give you almost like they improve your creativity because you're forced to get something done in a more quick time period?
Oh man, I hate projects with no deadlines or long deadlines. Oh. I love the, like, I worked on TV for, you know, a long time, and TV is a boot camp for working fast. Like you don't have a choice. You can never doubt your decisions. It's just, it's like go, go, go. And I always loved it because I work best that way. My best ideas come when I'm the most stressed. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan of working quickly. Cause some people think like, oh, you've got so much time. You're going to write a really gorgeous piece of work. And I'm like, no, I've got a lot of time, so it's going to sound lazy.
And you almost, would you say like when you have that much time, you almost get too self-reflective and then you start wondering, well, was this the best idea? Let me try to, you know, fine tune this.
Yeah. Or you just kind of never get to it. Cause you've got all these ideas that it's like a word salad in your head and you don't know where to begin. Whereas with a deadline, it's like, well, I have to get it done. Like that's the delivery day. So here I go, you know, and that's the feeling I like. Otherwise I'll just second guess and doubt myself, which is pointless.
It's kind of tangentially connected, but I can relate to that a lot. With the podcast specifically, when I have ideas or something like that, I have to put limits on myself. Like, well, I have to have this done by this date because otherwise I'll never get it done. I know me, I'm going to procrastinate like hell and it's just never going to happen. Nowhere nearly as intense as what you have to go through with composing music for, you know, companies and whatnot. But I can relate to that in a sense when it even down to the small degree with a podcast.
Yeah.
But all right, to kind of wrap all of this up, do you have any upcoming projects besides the Game Theory concert that we talked about? Is there any other projects that you want to talk about that you're working on or that you're able to talk about?
I have a few orchestra things that I unfortunately can't talk about, which sucks because I really want to, but Game Theory is consuming all my time. So, which is great. I can't wait to get it all done and just release it into the world.
And I guess we should say when that actually is. That is October 5th of this year, 2019, at the Ford Amphitheater in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Tickets are on sale at GameTheoryConcert.com. We're also partnered with Materia Collective, which is a label for game music that Sebastian Wolf has grown. And he's providing all kinds of cool merchandise for us and swag. If you get a ticket, you get a package with different items, depending on what tier you got, kind of like a Kickstarter. So everyone gets, you know, I hope everyone gets something about it when coming to Game Theory. And we're all raising money for musicians at play. And we would appreciate any help we can get.
And from what I can see with these ticket packages, you have like a $75 tier, a $95 tier, and the big one is the $125 one. And the $125 one's got a lot of cool stuff with it. I saw there's a compilation album, USB stick, exclusive badge and lanyard, a concert poster, and of course a concert ticket. Does the compilation album have like all the music that's going to be performed?
We're not sure yet. We're still working on it. So we're going to be announcing stuff as we go, as we grow the project. Unlike the other shows I worked on, which it's like, okay, this is Zelda, this is Pokemon, here's what we do. This one's a little more grassroots, and I don't have all the answers. So it's like we're all figuring this out together, and that's what the fun of this. That's what the project was supposed to be. So yeah, I guess we'll see what happens when we release it into the world.
I'm looking forward to it. So, Chad, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Josh. It was my pleasure. Good chatting with you.
And I will talk to you later.
Yeah, talk to you later.